The U.S. reportedly considering the resumption of sales of offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia ahead of a visit by President Biden to Riyadh. China calls on Southeast Asian countries to avoid being used as, quote, chess pieces by big powers. It says many countries in the region are under pressure to take sides. Bosnian Muslims are holding funerals for 50 more victims of a massacre committed by Bosnian Serb forces during the 1990s war. This is World News coming your way live from our Tehran studios. I'm Behruz Najafi. Welcome. Top story this hour, the U.S. is reportedly considering the resumption of sales of offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia, and this ahead of a visit by President Biden to Riyadh this week. Discussions are reportedly at an early stage, and the decision hinges on Saudi Arabia ending the war in Yemen. That was what Biden pledged during the early months of his presidency. His administration, though, has continued to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, which rights groups say were used to commit war crimes in Yemen. The U.S. is facing surging fuel prices and inflation. Washington and its Western allies have urged Riyadh to increase oil production to ease soaring prices that have taken a heavy toll on their economies.
After spending his first year and a half in office mostly trying to avoid deeper engagement in West Asia while prioritizing challenges at home and in other parts of the world such as China and Russia, President Biden seems to be making a slight shift towards dedicating more time and attention to West Asia. One of the main purposes of Joe Biden's visit is the so-called deepening of Israel's integration in the region. And moving forward with the Abraham Accords, which is the main pillar of normalization deals with Israel. But the latter has raised questions regarding Biden's foreign policies, as Israel itself seems to be the source of the problem in the region, from its atrocities against Palestinians to its continuous attacks on Syria and its repeated threats against Iran.
Well, Israel has been the problem in the Middle East since their inception. And even before that, when they were under British occupation, Palestine was under British occupation, the Zionists were the cause of the problems in the Middle East, going back to the bombing of the King David Hotel. So Israel has been a really terrible neighbor for all of the surrounding countries to them. You mentioned Syria. Yes, I was in Syria several times when Israel was being the aggressor and actively bombing the Syrian people who've done nothing to them. They occupy Syrian territory in the Golan Heights. Israel has been just a terrible neighbor to everyone. They've been abusive of the Palestinian people. I've been to the Palestinian, what they call camps, refugee camps, and these are 70 years old now. These are not new. These are established communities that they refer to as camps. They drove the people off their land. They stole their land that they have no right and no claim to. So yes, Israel is the nexus of the problem in the Middle East.
Now, despite Israeli crimes, Washington seems to not only integrate the regime further into the region, it also aims to advance its plan to upgrade defense cooperation between Israel and the Arabs in the light of the Abraham Accords. Meanwhile, Iran has reiterated that normalization of relations between some Arab countries and Israel encourages and strengthens the regime to continue its crimes. President Ebrahim Raisi in April even compared friendship with Israel to keeping a snake in proximity.
The U.S. government has been under fire for supporting Israeli and Saudi leaders and its weak response to human rights violations, from crimes committed against the Palestinians to the case of Shirin Abu Akleh and Jamal Khashoggi. And now Joe Biden seems to be ignoring the crimes to compensate for his administration's wrong economic policies.
Americans have been feeling the economic pressure of inflation in recent months, with surging domestic gasoline prices adding to that burden. There are expectations that President Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia will include a direct request from the kingdom to increase its oil production in the hopes of offsetting the rising costs for American consumers at the pump. During his campaign, Biden had pledged of making Saudi Arabia a pariah. But now, in a move seen by rights advocates as at odds with his promise to put human rights at the heart of U.S. foreign policy, Biden is set to meet with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as he struggles to combat record-high U.S. gasoline prices.
Biden has done some very foolish economic policies in the U.S. Initially, like day one after his inauguration, he cut off the Keystone Pipeline. And he turned the United States from an oil exporting country into an oil importing country. What Biden was not counting on was the rest of the world is sanctioning the U.S. and not wanting to deal in dollars, and they're not wanting to supply the U.S. with commodities and or finished goods. So Biden's economic policies have been an unmitigated failure. And so, yes, Biden is going to Saudi Arabia to beg the Saudis to increase oil production.
Meanwhile, the United States is facing accusations of whitewashing the Israeli killing of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh after concluding the bullet that killed her likely came from Israeli military gunfire, but stopping short of reaching a definitive conclusion in her killing. Abu Akleh was wearing a press uniform while reporting on an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank when she was fatally shot in the head on May 11th. Since the killing, several media and human rights organizations have all determined that the Israeli military killed Abu Akleh. All this raises the question of whether the U.S. truly seeks justice and advocates for human rights, or it only claims to do so in order to move forward with its agenda.
Moving on, a founding member of the Saudi opposition National Assembly Party has been killed in Lebanon. The party says that Mani Al-Yami was assassinated in suspicious circumstances on Saturday. It's called for a just and transparent probe into his death, accusing Saudi authorities of failing to protect citizens seeking freedom abroad. Yami was living in Lebanon since 2015. He helped found the National Assembly Party that was established in exile in 2020. It seeks an elected parliament in the autocratic Saudi Arabia. Hitman acting under the Saudi Crown Prince killed another dissident, Jamal Khashoggi, in Turkey in 2018. China urging Southeast Asian countries to avoid being used as chess pieces by big powers. The Chinese foreign minister says that the region is at risk of being reshaped by geopolitical factors. Wang Yi says many countries are under pressure to take sides. He stressed the region should be protected from geopolitical calculations and coercion. The official made those comments in a meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, in Jakarta. Wang Yi also talked about Taiwan and warned about what he called illusions about separating the island from China. Beijing is locked in dispute with Washington over its military and diplomatic support for Taiwan. Now, Bosnian Muslims are holding funerals for 50 more victims of a massacre committed by Bosnian Serb forces during the 1990s war. The remains of the newly identified victims laid to rest on the 27th anniversary of the Srebrenica massacre, the world's worst genocide since World War II. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell paid tribute to the victims and said that Europe failed and we are faced with our shame. In July 1995, some 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men and boys were systematically massacred by Bosnian Serb forces and buried them in mass graves. According to the Missing Persons Institute of Bosnia-Herzegovina, some 1,200 people are still missing. Around 100,000 people, mostly Muslims, were killed during the 1992 to 1995 inter-ethnic war in Bosnia. The Japanese government has called for a probe into the security loopholes in the assassination of former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Chief Cabinet Secretary Matsuno says that the government has received a report suggesting fault in the security and guard system. Abe was fatally shot while speaking at a campaign event in the western city of Nara on Friday. The suspect is in custody and has confessed to the assassination. The shooter mentioned Abe's alleged ties to a religious organization linked to the bankruptcy of his family. The killing has drawn condemnations from world leaders. The situation is escalating in Sri Lanka amid political turmoil and months of protests against the country's dire economic situation. Hashtag Trending reviews the story on social media.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here, back with another Hashtag Trending. Uncertainty over Sri Lanka's leadership continues as protesters still occupy the president's residence a day after they stormed it. And this is while the whereabouts of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa remain unknown. Sri Lanka's financial and political crisis, driven by the country's mix of high indebtedness, soaring inflation, and poor economic management, has led to months and months of political turmoil. The South Asian country defaulted on its debt in May, and an acute lack of foreign currency has left it unable to secure energy supplies. For most Sri Lankans, daily life has revolved around waiting for hours in line for fuel or waiting for the electricity to come back up. Our first tweet of the day comes from Fatima Iqbal Zubair. A massive coalition, People Power, in my homeland of Sri Lanka just overthrew a failing, corrupt president who had put the country in a massive economic crisis. Change is coming. Chudari Parvez has our next tweet. Sri Lanka protesters start preparing and cooking food inside the premises of the residence of the Sri Lanka PM in Colombo as they continue to remain there amid ongoing protests against the country's financial turmoil. Check it out. And our next tweet comes from Dr. Srinivas Alapati. Sri Lanka turmoil should be an eye-opener to the other democracies. Public unrest turned into a violent protest due to wrong policies, inflation, and complete political irresponsibility. Escalation of prices of essential commodities putting unbearable burden on the public. Sri Lanka's opposition political parties already met on Sunday to agree on a new government. They say that all opposition parties combined could easily muster the 113 members needed to show a majority in parliament to call for the formation of a new government. Our next batch of comments starts with a tweet by Tony Hudson. How come the people in Sri Lanka are in turmoil regarding the cost of living? People are queuing for petrol and diesel. The economy is in a mess. People cannot drive to work as they have no fuel. I forgot to mention they are not big gas or oil suppliers. Niha Masih said the announcement of the resignation marked a major win for the protesters but plunged Sri Lanka into political turmoil over what happens next. People thronged the president's home, picnicking in the gardens and swimming in the pool. Imran Khan has our next tweet. Sri Lanka's main opposition parties agreed to form all-party interim government after anticipated resignation of President Gotabaya Rajapaksa following unprecedented political turmoil that forced him and PM Ranil Wickremesinghe to offer resignations. Joydeep Dutta has another tweet. Multilateral cooperation is highly required in this unprecedented ongoing situation to mitigate the crisis-ridden Sri Lanka's food shortages and economic turmoil, also to ensure the public security with a greater resolution of recent political crisis. Economists say that Sri Lanka's crisis stems from domestic factors, such as years of mismanagement and corruption. Now the country is relying on aid from India as well as other nations, while its leaders are trying to negotiate a bailout with the International Monetary Fund. Our final batch of comments starts with a tweet by Lars Brovold. Mr. Blinken blaming Russia for the Sri Lanka economic turmoil isn't honest when the U.S. and NATO prolong the Ukraine special military operation by intervening on one side of the conflict. Ukraine is turning into another Syria-style war by proxy to the very detriment of that proxy. Kay Diallo said, over the last 50 years, the IMF has given Sri Lanka 16 loans. The imperialist neoliberal reforms pushed on Sri Lanka as part of these loans are one of the key causes of the current crisis. Today, a huge U.S.-led campaign to conceal this involvement is underway. The final comment comes from Carlos. Attempting to blame Chinese debt trap for the Sri Lanka crisis is either shameless propaganda or willful ignorance. China holds 10% of Sri Lanka's foreign debt, generally at lower interest rates and longer repayment terms. The bulk is held by Japan and the Western institutions. And with that, we have come to the end of another edition of Hashtag Trending. Take care and bye-bye.
Skepticism abounds in the EU around the idea that relations between the bloc and Britain will improve once Prime Minister Boris Johnson leaves office. Brussels and London remain at loggerheads over post-Brexit trading arrangements related to Northern Ireland. From Brussels, Jerome Hughes has the story.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland.
The political developments do not change our position on the protocol or the way in which we work with our British counterparts on Northern Ireland. Our position is that we should endeavour to seek solutions on the implementation of the protocol, and that's it.
The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace, just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better. Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic.
The new Prime Minister will carry on more or less the same policy as Boris Johnson, with one difference that maybe he would be a bit more honest with the British citizen.
Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but he didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much, unless there's a snap election and then, say, like Labour take over something. I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, the departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU.
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer. No. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Newly leaked documents lay bare potentially illegal and ethically questionable tactics used by the American company Uber to grow its business globally. The files detail how the company lobbied governments to help it evade regulators. And that includes French President Macron, who was the economy minister back then and proved an ally to Uber. The documents also show how the taxi firm's former chief prevented the police from accessing files on its main server by shutting down systems. According to those files, the startup also sought to use violent attacks against its drivers during the 2016 anti-Uber protests to win public sympathy. The company has stopped short of denying the allegations. It says it's moved from the policy of its former chief and changed how it does business. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with the concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam's endeavor to bring about a serious separation from Westerners would have naturally created some enemies because he would not allow them to interfere. He took the current Palestinian embassy, which was in the hands of the usurping Zionist regime at that time, away from the Zionists and handed it over to the Palestinians, who are the owners of Palestine. Well, this naturally brings about enmity. This is the course of nature. Our youth must pay attention to this. Westerners looted the world for three centuries. For three centuries, they looted the world. Westerners looted the whole world, ranging from Eastern Asia, Indonesia, the Philippines, and the Indian subcontinent, to Central Asia, West Asia, North Africa, West Africa, and the entire sub-Saharan region of the continent. And they were not satisfied with that either. They even laid their hands on South America. They looted the American continent as well. The American continent had its own owners. It had a civilization with certain nations. They created disaster with various tricks. All these are clear in authoritative history books. You should read books in order to understand these matters more tangibly.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They engaged in murder, plunder, massacre, torture, pressure, and slavery. Westerners did these things during those three centuries. While Westerners were busy committing these crimes, their intellectuals and thinkers would discover and impose human rights for the world. This contradiction in action and in words, and this hypocrisy is clear. Their actions and words were different. European countries, followed by US, committed all sorts of crimes throughout the world in the literal sense of the word. Well, these are the masterpieces of the Western civilization. These are the works of art created by Westerners. Imam knew these things well. One of the main issues on which Imam would insist was to create a distance and border between the Islamic thinking, lifestyle, and government from Western governments. This was one of the major concerns of Imam.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United Nations has warned the Israeli regime against forcible mass eviction of over 1,000 Palestinians from their homes in the Masafer Yatta area of the occupied West Bank.
Evictions that lead to displacement, if enforced, amount to forced deportation and a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention, and therefore constitute a war crime.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs added that the international humanitarian law imposes an absolute prohibition on the forcible transfer of civilians from or within the occupied Palestinian territories, and that Israeli authorities must put an end to all coercive measures, including planned evictions, demolitions, and military training in it.
Well, the Palestinians have been periodically rising up against this ongoing slow-motion Zionist genocide. It's been going on now. The Palestinians have been resisting this genocide for more than a century since it began, when these settlers started swarming into Palestine against the wishes of the Palestinian people. And so that struggle will, of course, continue. And there will be continuing protests. There are basically ongoing peaceful protests in Palestine. And every now and then, the uprising becomes more of a military nature. And then, of course, the Zionists respond in kind, and all kinds of blood is shed. At the end of the day, the Zionists are continuing their slow-motion genocide, but it isn't happening fast enough to save them. In the long run, the Zionist entity is doomed because it hasn't been able to get the actual acquiescence of the Palestinians, first and foremost, and then secondarily, the people of the region.
A ruling by the Israeli Supreme Court on May 4th allowed for the mass eviction of Palestinians in the area. The Israeli military has designated part of the area as a closed military zone for training, and the regime has sought to remove the communities on this basis. The European ambassador to the occupied Palestinian territories has warned against Israel's planned evictions.
If mass evictions and forcible transfer were to be the case, that would be the biggest forcible transfer for decades.
The official added that the EU hopes that upcoming visits of US President Joe Biden to Israel would put pressure on Israel to fulfill its obligations to protect civilians.
The US could stop Israel from all of its crimes if it absolutely turned and chose that path. but it won't. And the reason, of course, is that there's a lot of Zionist power here in the United States, including in the Biden administration. And they're sending a message by saying, even when Biden goes to the Middle East, and it would be in his interest and the American interest to have the Israelis modify their behavior, they won't do it. They don't need to do it. They're thumbing their nose at the world. And the Zionists have a long track record of things like this. They never compromise. They never try to go the extra mile to be reasonable.
Although the United States has called on the Israeli regime to stop its settlement drive, but in effect, it has supported the regime in its crimes against Palestinians. U.S. officials have repeatedly hailed Washington's unwavering support for the regime. They have also turned a deaf ear to growing cries from various international organizations regarding the regime's atrocities. The United States has also vetoed numerous resolutions in the UN Security Council that criticize the regime.
Amid ongoing diplomatic efforts to revive the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, the U.S. has introduced fresh sanctions against Iran. Washington claims the measures target an international network of individuals and entities that allegedly facilitated the sale of Iranian petroleum and petrochemical products to East Asia. The move comes ahead of President Biden's visit to the region next week. Last week, Iran held high-stake diplomatic talks in the Qatari capital, Doha, to restore the JCPOA, with the EU coordinator, Enrique Mora, shuttling between Iran's top negotiator, Ali Bagherikani, and Robert Malley, the U.S. special envoy for Iran. Following the talks, Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, rejected claims made by U.S. officials about new demands raised by the Iranian delegation in the Doha talks, saying the Islamic Republic's requests are in line with the 2015 accord. He said, contrary to U.S. media claims, Tehran put forward no excessive demands that goes beyond the framework of the JCPOA.
برخلاف برخی ادعاهای رسانه‌ای طرف آمریکایی ما هیچ گونه مطالبه زیاد خواهانه ای نداریم هیچ گونه مطالبه فرابرجامی مورد ادعای آمریکا را نداریم مطالبات ما کاملا در چارچوب توافق سال 2015 است
امیر عبداللهیان's remarks came in response to US special envoy for Iran Robert Malley claimed that Tehran came up with new demands at the Doha talks. The U.S. State Department spokesman, Ned Price, echoed Malley's remarks, claiming that Iran has consistently introduced extraneous demands, demands that, or issues that, go beyond the four walls of the JCPOA. Iran is pursuing the JCPOA talks, while Israel has been sounding the alarm about Iran, its regional influence, and its alleged efforts of weaponizing its nuclear program.
And Israel is far from wanting the interests of the countries of the region. On the other hand, we see that the countries in the region like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan, they're talking to each other, they're meeting in Baghdad. They've met several times in Arab and Middle Eastern capitals. So they are capable of sorting out their problems. And therefore, any relationship with Israel would be detrimental and against the interest of the countries of the Middle East.
Meanwhile, a top Iranian security official has warned against forming alliances with Israel, saying that such moves endanger the security of the region. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, says that any alliance with the Israeli regime, even of a non-security and non-military nature, will pose serious threats to the stability and security of the Middle East region. Shamkhani made the remarks in a meeting with the visiting Qatari Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani, in Tehran. He underlined the emphasis on neighboring countries in the Islamic Republic's foreign policy, asserting that Tehran's coherent policy towards its neighbors is to expand all-out and strategic relations on the principle of good neighborliness. Separately, Shamkhani warned that the Islamic Republic opposes any move that changes regional geopolitics. This was in reference to a so-called Arab NATO, a plan that was a non-starter when it was introduced by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. This military regional alliance was due to Israel and the U.S. sounding the alarm over the perceived threat coming from Iran.
The Iranophobia is something very natural to happen in the West. because it is one of the U.S. tools against a country like Iran, like Russia, who refused to submit to the U.S. hegemony.
Iran has rejected such a notion and has said that through regional cooperation, security can be established. Iran believes that Israel and the presence of foreign forces are the source of instability. The UK Prime Minister fought as hard as he could, but he finally gave in. Boris Johnson has resigned as the Conservative Party leader. This will pave the way for a successor to replace him as the British Prime Minister, after over 50 of his ministers quit the government. He will, however, continue as Prime Minister until autumn. A Tory leadership race will take place this summer, and the winner will replace Johnson by October. Boris Johnson's premiership plunged into crisis following the dramatic resignations of Chancellor Rishi Sunak and the Health Secretary Sajid Javid. Javid, who served as the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, made reference to Johnson's failed leadership as the reason for quitting his post.
And now this week again, we have reason to question the truth and integrity of what we've all been told. And at some point, we have to conclude that enough is enough. Yeah. I believe that point is now.
Further resignations have followed, with the education ministers Will Quince and Robin Walker and ministerial aide Laura Trott quitting.
He had scandal after scandal, miscalculation after miscalculation. He's lost the confidence of, I assume, the country, going by the recent by-election results. And more recently, he's lost the confidence of many senior members of his government, with over 40 of them now resigning.
Johnson was under mounting pressure after apologizing for appointing MP Christopher Pincher to a role involved in offering pastoral care to his party, even after being briefed that the politician had been the subject of complaints about sexual misconduct.
He knew the accused minister had previously committed predatory behavior, but he promoted him to a position of power anyway. Why?
They're looking at the future. They're looking at the next Conservative government being returned in 2024. I believe they feel that won't happen with Boris Johnson at the helm. Therefore, people are jockeying for position. The knives are out. It's a Caesar and Brutus type political ending of his career.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson and the scandals that surrounded him drowned his political life, and he found himself to have fallen out of favor with the general public in the UK. Prior to his resignation, a snap YouGov poll had found that 69% of Britons thought that Johnson should step down as Prime Minister. The timing of his resignation could not be any worse. The UK is experiencing a cost of living crisis like no other time in its history. Many Britons are struggling to cope with rising fuel and food prices. Economists say that the country is now heading for a sharp slowdown or possibly a recession.
He is, for his own political, selfish purposes, been running this country's economy into the ground, and worse, far worse, he has been threatening a peace process. That's all I've got to say.
And things will get much, much worse before the next general election. And I think regardless of who wins that election, we will continue to see an economic crisis.
Now with a new administration set to take the helm in September or in early October, the real concern for the UK is how it will cope with the economic crisis until then. This is not to dismiss the fact that there are no guarantees that the new administration will be able to deal with the economic onslaught that will be piled on it.
I'm sickened myself and furious about that.
The International Federation of Journalists, or IFJ, says the Federation will be a partner in the lawsuit filed against the Israeli occupation in the International Criminal Court. A member of the executive board of the Federation says the move came after the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate succeeded in persuading the Federation to file a lawsuit against Israel in the International Criminal Court. IFJ stated that the filing comes in light of the Israeli aggression against Palestinian journalists and people. Earlier, the Journalist Syndicate had said that it succeeded in exposing Israel's acts of aggression against media professionals and the Palestinian people. The circumstances of Shirin Abu Akleh's killing on May the 11th have been investigated by several international organizations. All concluded that it was a bullet fired from an Israeli rifle that killed the Al Jazeera correspondent and injured her fellow journalist as they covered an Israeli raid in Jenin. Multiple witnesses also agreed with the probes, stating that Israeli forces shot the veteran Palestinian reporter. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera and its host country Qatar pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. But the question is, will there and can there be accountability for the crimes committed by Israel?
And the absence of punishment shows hypocrisy, double standards, and deception and lies. So this is an opportunity for journalists to present all of the best documented evidence, research, discovery that they've done about crimes against humanity that the Israeli apartheid regime has committed. And the more international they go, the louder they go, the more they invite other countries to be participants, to join the lawsuit against Israel, the more you're building international consensus in support of the people who have been violated, dehumanized, killed, robbed, or in other way injured by this grotesque apartheid Israeli policy and agenda of genocide, bigotry, and destruction. So it's a very essential step, and I'm glad they're taking it.
Earlier this month, Palestinian officials handed over to U.S. forensic experts the bullet that killed Abu Akleh. But despite all the evidence pointing fingers towards Israel, the U.S. said it could not reach a definitive conclusion on the origin of the bullet. Meanwhile, Abu Akleh's family have expressed their anger over the U.S.'s disregard for what several courts and rights organizations have stated and its failure to accept that its ally has murdered a journalist in broad daylight. The International Federation of Journalists, or IFJ, says that Israel was guilty of the crime and expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into Palestinian journalist Abu Akleh's killing. The U.S., on the other hand, has not condemned this act, yet aside from saying there needs to be an independent investigation, raising questions about whether the U.S. is seeking the truth or to protect its ally.
Well, absolutely, the U.S. is guilty of supporting the regime. The U.S. is guilty from enabling the regime to engage in war crimes and crimes against humanity. The U.S. has been guilty of stealing money from the American people and giving it to the Israeli apartheid regime and giving them weapons and, in fact, looking the other way when Israel had developed nuclear weapons, but that's another story. But Israel's crimes and abuses against the Palestinians, against the Syrians, against Lebanon, against all sorts of countries and nations and peoples, the U.S. is the partner in crime that is responsible. And if the U.S. does not hold a moral standard and a very clear objectivity and a dedication to truth and justice, then the U.S. is showing that it has no dedication to truth and justice, but instead has a dedication to lies and crime.
The murder of Abu Akleh, which sparked global outrage, only adds to Israel's long list of atrocities against Palestinians. But that fury has yet to translate into any concrete measures, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. So far, several international organizations have provided evidence of Israel's brutality against Palestinians. UN resolutions have also been passed against Israel. Yet no one, including the United Nations Security Council, has used any of its tools to ensure its resolutions. Meanwhile, the International Criminal Court has ruled that it has a mandate to investigate the occupied territories and has accepted the Palestinians after they were granted non-member observer status at the UN. This comes despite Palestinians' inability to join the ICC, as Israel is not a member and Palestinians do not qualify as a sovereign state.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله
The Prophet, who was the wise gerent of Allah, whom all acknowledged when he would sit in the mosque, a person coming from outside would not be able to identify him because there was no top and bottom of seating arrangement involved. At that time, there was no such things as flooring beneath him. He would sit on a mat if it was available. Otherwise, he would sit on the floor. It is Islam we want to, but we do not have the strength to present it as it is. But one must strive as much as he can to get close to the source of goodness.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. In this program, we talk about the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini, and in today's program, we will talk about Shiism. In one of his speeches, he says that Imam means leader and the one who guides and leads a group towards a certain directions. The Imam is the one who explains the policy of Shiism and the Hezbollah, which is the party of Allah. And it is the leader and his entire duties and functions that he deduced from the Quran and the Sunnah of Prophet of Islam at various times and in different conditions and advises them accordingly. In this part of his speech, he is basically talking about the concept of Imam that in Shiism we have. Because in Shiism, we follow the concept of Imam and Ummah. The leader and the nation. There is only one leader at all times. There must be a leader at one time, and that must be an infallible person, which is being chosen by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the way He chose the prophets.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi.
For the Imamah, obviously, we have the verses in the Quran where we can definitely refer to the verse number 124 of chapter Baqarah, which is the second chapter, in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said to the Prophet Ibrahim that وإذ ابتلى إبراهيم ربه بكلمات فأتمهن فقال إني جاعلك للناس إماما. Then all the trials, they were finished, and Abraham alayhi salam, the prophet Ibrahim, was successful in those trials. He was a prophet when he had trials. He had to leave his son in the desert. He had to sacrifice his son in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The revelation was upon the prophet Ibrahim, and he had a religion. He has conveyed all the teachings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to the public. And after that, when everything was finished, Allah said, Inni ja'iluka linnasi imama. Look, Ibrahim, now you are being the imam. We're going to make you imam. Why? Because after you have received all the revelations, all the rules and laws of Islam, which you are spreading in your nation, now you need to become a leader who can apply all these things in the society, who can advise them according to the things that I have revealed. Similarly, in Islam, after the Prophet ﷺ, we believe in Imam, who basically advises according to the Sunnah of the Prophet of Islam and the Quran. And this is the duty of Imam when we refer to an Imam in the Shia school of thought.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that will affect the governments, communities, organizations, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how the film industry in Pakistan has degenerated owing to the overwhelming influence of Bollywood and Hollywood. And we shall also take a look at the history of cinema in Pakistan, its ebbs and flows, how it lost talent to Bangladesh, and how political tensions with India affected filmmaking.
Pakistan's beleaguered film industry is desperately looking for a fresh lease of life, but the struggle seems to be real. Despite great expectations, the South Asian country's cinema has failed to live up to its massive potential, mostly mimicking Bollywood and Hollywood. Instead of churning out films in line with the country's rich socio-cultural values and traditions, as well as themes people can relate to, the Pakistani cinema industry, known as Lollywood, has settled to being a rehashed version of overseas cinema.
The Pakistani cinema industry, now approaching 75 years of its existence, is still struggling to carve a niche for itself in the global entertainment sector. The reasons are plenty, but analysts mainly point to Lollywood being overshadowed by Bollywood and Hollywood, lack of technology, unimaginative screenwriting, and dwindling number of theaters in the country. The Pakistani film industry has failed to evolve on its own. In order to compete with its international counterparts, Lollywood has lost that Eastern touch to it. A top Pakistani actor, Hamza A. Abbasi, a few years ago lamented the impact that the Indian film industry has had in Pakistan and how filmmakers in Pakistan copy Bollywood.
Well, right now Indian cinema is hit in Pakistan. And I know I can't do it better than them. I can't make Dabang 3. They have bigger budgets. So we have stories. We don't depend on the masala.
Some Pakistani filmmakers have in the past expressed fears of the Indian film industry smothering the Pakistani cinema and damaging the country's Islamic culture and norms. The fact that some private channels in Pakistan distribute and promote Indian films illegally has also incurred huge losses to Pakistani filmmakers. However, it wasn't like this always. Before the 1980s, Pakistan had a thriving film industry and films didn't copy India or the West. The themes were in line with the country's rich cultural ethos. Then the decline began, followed by the slow death, which gradually opened the floodgates for Bollywood and Hollywood in Pakistan.
We could talk about the uplifting or further developing or improving the declining situation, if we could think about the national solidarity or unanimity or something like that. And then everybody has to talk about, they have their social freedom, maybe their national rights or statutory rights, whatever it is. But again, there has to be a policy for the national identity, for the sake of the national representative into the media. So this is what we are saying, is that what we can see, that there is a lack of a development. There is no chance of development unless there is some point where a substantiating or sufficient policy making is there.
After the Indian Army's airstrike in a tribal belt of Pakistan in early 2019, which led to heightened tensions between the two strange neighbors, Indian films were quickly pulled out of cinemas in Pakistan. For the past 3 years, Pakistani cinema has struggled to fill the vacuum. To make up for the loss, Pakistani filmmakers have tried to replicate the formula of Indian and Western cinema based on so-called liberal themes. As a result, the new films coming out from Pakistan have faced intense scrutiny for promoting wrong values and culture.
In an indication of how Bollywood and Hollywood have overshadowed Pakistan's ailing film industry, the Muslim-majority country's filmmakers have been trying to use the ingredients of Indian and Western cinema to churn out new Lollywood movies. In India and the U.S., which together account for an overwhelming majority of films produced globally, the so-called liberal themes, promoting vulgarity, immorality, and sleaze, dominate the New Age cinema. Instead of reviving their own tradition,